The Arthropod. The Arthropod is the home for the wonderful, weird, wacky world of insects. Hosted by Jonathan Larson, Jody Green, and Michael Scavarla.
Welcome back, everybody, to Arthropod, your entomology podcast. I am but one of your bug-filled hosts for the day, Jonathan Larson of the University of Kentucky.
I'm another one of your hosts, Jody Green from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln.
And I'm Michael Scavarla with Penn State University.
I'm the only bug-filled one. I was waiting to see what you would describe yourselves as.
I was going to make a comment like you're like Oogie Boogie from Nightmare Before Christmas.
Good. Yeah. Oh. I like that.
Oh, we are so calm today.
I'm the shadow on the moon at night. I'm going to put that on my CV. We're excited to be back with you today talking about locusts. I think that Jody's going to lead us off here talking a little bit about her adventures with locusts.
Well, in our last episode, we introduced the book that we all read. The title of the book is Locust, The Devastating Rise and Mysterious Disappearance of the Insect That Shaped the American Frontier. The author is Jeffrey Lockwood, and it was published in 2004. You can go back and listen to Arthropod episode 127 and take a listen if you want to hear our thoughts on the book in terms of how it was organized. What else did we talk about? Some descriptions of what early settlers experienced during the years of 1874 to 1877, about that time, when locusts descended on the earth and the farming communities across North America. We also talked about the formation of the U.S. Entomological Commission that was formed by Congress and included a dream team of three men that we spoke about in great length. One of them being a famous entomologist named Charles Valentine Riley, or C.V. Riley. Problem was so big and so important that this was like the first like comprehensive report about the Rocky Mountain locust because it had such a significant impact on science and our society. So what we didn't get into is the insect itself. And I want to let listeners and our co-hosts know that I actually got into locusts a little bit earlier this year. I read a paper about the desert locust outbreak that was occurring in Africa and Pakistan and places on the other side of the world. There is still, if you look up locust infestations or outbreaks, this is still occurring. It's a major problem. There was a national emergency actually declared right around when we were experiencing COVID-19 in 2020. So it's probably something that a lot of us weren't concerned with or thinking about at the time. But there are a lot of challenges with pest management over there. So I got kind of into just locusts and learning about them. So
to interrupt slightly, sorry. I think it's really interesting that in the year 2022, you were like setting up on locusts, because I think to a lot of our listeners, I know we have a very American bend in our listenership. So locusts seem like they're consigned to the past. And it is interesting when they pop up in the news, like you said, they show up and they're still causing this widespread devastation on other continents. So don't forget about them. They're still lurking out there.
Oh, yeah. And there are so many entomologists that are involved. Problems over there when they're doing pest management, it's things that we can't even fathom. And I think that's why I was so concerned about it. And I ended up writing a blog for Entomology Today, trying to make the paper more enticing for people to read everywhere, because I was just, I guess, taken with what you just said. So currently, you know, now that is one of the worst outbreaks in 70 years in Kenya, and one of the worst in 25 years in places like Ethiopia, Somalia, and India. So it's still the locust still threatens food supply across many regions around the world. To start off, what is a locust? Normally, my simple answer is, well, it's a type of grasshopper. And when I'm describing it that way, it's because I'm telling people that they're not talking about cicadas. So when they're like, oh, it's a locust, I'm like, no, a locust is a grasshopper. This is a cicada. In the book that we read on page 27, it simply states, a locust is a type of highly mobile grasshopper with the capacity to attain enormous population densities. How would either of you describe a locust when people ask you about it?
I've had kids ask me that a lot. Like when I would go out and do school visits, they would ask questions about locusts. I don't know if they were hearing about them at church or what was going on, but I think I always kind of described it as angry, sort of agitated, and maybe overcrowded grasshoppers. They've touched each other too much, and now they're very mad about it. And so they're going to put on some war paint and go eat all our food.
So like pretty just irritated.
Yeah, like a gross oversimplification, obviously, but like this idea of them sort of rubbing up against each other too much and smelling each other too much, I would also argue, kind of inducing this migratory behavior.
Okay. Mike, when someone says, what's a locust? What's your simple answer?
Oh man, I don't know if I could do simple.
Yeah, I think you have you've cornered.
I am the wrong person.
One adjective.
Okay. No, I think John's got it pretty right. Like they're grasshoppers of certain species, in not unrelated species, that as nymphs are in crowded conditions, so they're touching each other too much, they're encountering their own poop too much, and that gives them the cues to, instead of turning into a solitary grasshopper, turning into a gregarious locust.
You know that I'm not like, I don't do like comics and all that. Is it kind of like the Hulk? Like, cause I'm thinking of transformations. Is it kind of Hulk-like? Incredible.
Yeah. I think you can make some analogies to the Hulk of he gets agitated and then he turns into the Hulk. Like the emotional trauma on him makes him Hulk out. I think you can kind of lose that metaphor because it's not about all these different Hulks, all these different Bruce Banners touching each other and inducing Hulkiness. So
I'd read that comic though.
Okay. But it's distinct behavioral and physiological changes in these species of grasshoppers, essentially. Right.
For sure.
Yeah. So normally these are short winged solitary grasshoppers that feed on local vegetation in their native range. But under these certain conditions, like you're talking about poop and rubbing against each other and the pheromones and the ecological factors, they're going to go through this gregarious social phase. And so they're going to transform into these long-winged migratory crop-destroying machines. Is that correct to say that?
Yeah, absolutely. It seems like the kids grow up in a crowded neighborhood and then, yeah, they take it out on everything around them.
They can also go back to the short-winged phase.
Yes, over multiple generations.
Yeah.
So it's not like once you're a locust as an adult, you're not going to turn back into the short-winged phase like you. But if you disperse enough and you lay your eggs in an area where there are fewer nymphs, then your progeny may turn into the short-winged phase. The problem is all your neighbors are also locusts. And so chances are your progeny are going to grow up and have too many neighbors and also grow up into locusts because everybody is out there with you.
Yeah, it's so fascinating how, I mean, I already have my own issues with grasshoppers, which we can talk about later, but I have to go through some of the definitions of what a locust plague is. Well, I mean, we talk about swarms, bands, outbreaks. So I'm going to go through what that actually means in terms of stages of locust development. But
awesome.
So a band, you know, a band,
right.
A musical band. It's a band. Yeah. So these are what they call hoppers, which are the immature nymphs. So grasshoppers and locusts, they go through incomplete metamorphosis. So egg, nymph, adult, and all the nymphs look like adults, but they're not able to mate and reproduce, and they don't have wings. So these are called, when they have a lot of these immature nymphs or hoppers, they're called bands. So bands of these locusts are the ones that are immature.
So is this evocative of like they're in a big line with each other and they're like walking across the field in a band feeding on stuff?
Yeah. And then when they come together, different bands come together like a concert, I suppose, it'd be like an outbreak. So their bands crowd in an area.
Okay.
And then when they swarm, those are the winged adults. So they've developed and they're winged. So that's a swarm. And that's similar to when, you know, we have swarming ants and swarming termites. They're there to meet each other, mate. It's swarms, a swarm.
Swarms, right? Necessitate wings is what you're saying.
Yes.
Okay.
And then an upsurge is successive generations of highly densely breeding. So this takes place over months with these swarms. And then a plague is multiple outbreaks plus an upsurge. So this is years. So plagues take years and many, many generations. So
I'm glad to hear that there are like, there's science behind using the term plague, like that we plucked that from the Bible. Yeah. And said, yeah, we're gonna put some numbers on this.
Right. So when I was writing that blog, I wanted to make sure I was using the right terms because I knew, you know, nothing about these locusts. And so that was really interesting. So I never thought we would actually be reading this book and I would be, ever be talking about locusts again. But when I talked a little bit about the ecological conditions that favor swarm development, so why this actually happens, they talk about it in the book, but it's like this prolonged period of drought. So there isn't a lot of water. And then all of a sudden it's followed by heavy rains. So the areas that have good soil and hold the moisture, it could be like lowland areas or certain places where they will have good vegetation. And so that migration and that swarm will end up right there. And this could also be helped with like the wind speed to help that locust migration. But it's that changing climate can produce more frequent outbreaks and bigger swarms and also more widespread food insecurity when that occurs. Now, weather does play a big part in locust swarms, still, you know, on the other side of the world too, where the hot, dry weather will encourage that more often. So
I'm glad that we don't have anything going on that's going to increase climatic variability and extreme weather events and possibly result in more of this.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm also glad that the climate is extremely stable right now.
Right. Not changing in any way, shape, or form. Obviously sarcasm. Is that part of what part of what you were learning about when you were doing your writing earlier this year? Is this something that people in the locust community are concerned with?
Yeah, because a lot of these kind of things, like we can't control those. I mean, you know, we're trying to in some places. But we've done this to, you know, the environment. So these things are changing and we're going to maybe have more outbreaks, more frequent. When we think about, you know, some of the insects that we have here just in the U.S., I mean, even with fall armyworm, you know, a lot of that was dependent on the weather we had. So,
yeah, people don't like hearing that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In the book on page 22, in locust, they talked about the locust flourished during these droughts that led to population growth. And he mentioned like dry conditions suppressed fungal diseases and predators. So the predator prey cycle, you know, maybe less birds or other predators have grasshoppers and biological control, then that would suppress that. So there'd be greater feeding. So all of those things are connected. But the last Rocky Mountain locust was collected in, say, 1902. And then this was after the U.S. Entomological Commission had its report out, and there were several theories as to why they disappeared. So, I mean, after having, you know, a plague and all these years and expecting right. this and then having this huge report, and now they know, you know, all so much about them, they just disappeared. Did you guys want to talk about some of the theories on how that happened? Because it was very surprising.
Well, first, I want to call the locust a coward. Like they were scared of C.V. Riley at all, right? Like they'd rather go extinct than deal with the Entomological Commission. It does seem like the commission got started at the tail end of everything, sort of expecting all of this extravagant problem to deal with. And then it kind of petered out. Things didn't go back to normal necessarily, but it does seem like this is a boom and bust cycle as we went through the latter half of the book. There are multiple references to the fact that if you go back in history, it's probable that this happened not on a cycle that you could set a clock to, but that this is a cyclical thing that occurs and we went out of the cycle, it seems like, or there was some sort of variable that got changed. And that's sort of the big thing that Lockwood seems interested in. Like the first half of the book, when we talked last time, it was very religious. It was very experiential. We talked a lot about how people felt about locust problems and the sights and sounds and smells of it. Jody still wonders if she isn't being infected with Nebraskan orthopteran fear. I didn't know if you wanted to talk more about that.
Yeah. So after we had our discussion last episode, I was like, you know what? I really do dislike grasshoppers. I actually, they're my least favorite insect, which I'm asked about all the time. And I was thinking, like, do I have like this bias against grasshoppers because of the notion of locusts? And do I have I been brainwashed into being fearful of them? And then I thought about how you used to always say, like, would you rather be around? What were your questions?
Would you rather fight two horse-sized gerbils or 100 gerbil-sized wolves or something like that? Like, yeah. Very, very ridiculous things.
Yeah. And then I would actually like see them. I'd have that like visual, and then I would pick one. So I was like, I do not want to see locusts. I would not want to see like 50 grasshoppers. If you released 50 like grasshoppers or locusts in my office, I'd be like, see you later. Bye. Give me a like horse-sized gerbil.
And right away into the sunset.
Yeah. But I think anything that's bad here in Nebraska is called locust.
It seemed like it. Yeah. And I do think that's an artifact of the past. I'm intrigued by this like self evaluation that you're having, trying to figure out if you've been brainwashed to dislike grasshoppers in particular. But that was really, I think, a big focus of the first episode. And then also talking about the Entomological Commission. The second half of this book is really about this cold, quote unquote, cold case that Lockwood has set up. Even in the middle there, he kind of describes it as like, oh, imagine the CIA or FBI stumbles upon this, or I don't remember what agency he uses, but.
Well, he writes it like that, like he's describing a murder mystery, which, spoiler alert, he goes on after he kind of retires from being an entomologist and transitions into being, he's now a fiction writer who writes murder mysteries. So like, this is presaging like his career advance, very much so.
Right, right. We all reveal ourselves in due time.
Before we get into the different theories that he lays out that people had proposed in the literature for why they went extinct, the one thing I think is interesting that he points out is that, you know, Rocky Mountain locusts go in this cyclical pattern, and the commission caught this last cycle, and then they disappear for a while, and everybody's kind of just waiting for the next outbreak. And it's like 30, 40, 50 years before entomologists kind of look around and be like, oh shoot, it's gone.
Right.
Like, it doesn't immediately occur to everybody that Rocky Mountain locusts have disappeared. We're just like, oh, we're in between cycles. And then it just slow dawning that they've gone extinct, or at least haven't outbroken. And it is kind of covered up because some of these other grasshopper species that aren't necessarily locusts, other melanoplines that are related to Rocky Mountain locusts, are outbreaking, not as locusts, but as like their solitary forms, just having big outbreaks. And so it's kind of masking historically that Rocky Mountain locusts aren't there, because there's still grasshopper problems in the plain states.
Still grasshoppers, still other problems. And I also think it has to be said that we often don't fathom that something on a scale such as this could go away, right? Like, it's impossible. You know, there was trillions of them. There was a cloud that covered the Great Plains of locusts. Like, they can't possibly have disappeared. And then, whoops, it looks like they did.
They haven't been here for 40 years. I guess they're gone.
Right. And we are running out of them in collections. I have to assume that these were like dissected and stuff, like just used as garbage specimens for a lot of things.
But that is one neat thing that he talks about, at least in passing. You know, for there being trillions of these in any given outbreak, there's only something like 400 specimens in collections. They were so numerous, nobody collected them, because you just assume like they're like houseflies.
Right.
What entomologist collects the common housefly in his house or her house and puts it in their collection? Like, they're so common as to be ignored. And so we just don't have them in collections. They're rare now.
Let that be a lesson to us. Put the Japanese beetle, put the housefly, all of these different things in the collections, and make sure that we've got them for the future.
That's a good point, Mike. Maybe you want to talk about the species and how they determined if it was the same species or not. Like, how did they go through and identify it that way?
The scientific name of Rocky Mountain locust is Melanoplus spiritus. Part of the issue with determining that Rocky Mountain locust was extinct is we only ever had the migratory phase. We didn't have examples of the solitary phase of this species. And it wasn't clear for a long time if some of these, what we now know are related species, like Melanoplus sanguipes, Melanoplus femur rubrum, the red-legged locust, which isn't a locust, the red-legged grasshopper. For a while, there was debate, like, is Rocky Mountain locust the migratory form of these other species? And so Lockwood talks about, I forget who it was, but they figured out that grasshopper genitalia for the males is a great way to determine species relationships and what a species is in grasshoppers. In grasshoppers, the male and female genitalia act like a lock and key. And so within a species, they all look the same, but between species, they look very different, because if you find another grasshopper and you want to mate with them, the lock has to meet with the key. And so that keeps, that's a between species barrier, a prezygotic barrier to mating. There we go. Digging that term up from 20 years ago in intro bio. It's a way to keep species distinct and stop them from hybridizing. And so once they figured out that you can use genitalia to distinguish species, then we figured out, like, okay, Rocky Mountain locust, the genitalia are different from femur rubrum, from Melanoplus sanguipes, from these other Melanoplus species. So it is a distinct species and it's not here anymore. Like, we still have femur rubrum, we still have sanguipes, we still have Melanoplus bruneus. They're extant, they're still outbreaking, but where's Rocky Mountain locust? And so that was part of the reason that we didn't know that it went extinct, because it wasn't clear that it was a distinct species for quite some time. Melanoplus are extremely common and abundant and diverse across North America. There are a bunch of species in all types of habitats. There are actually a number of new species being described every year, because many of them are short-winged. They don't fly as adults, and so they become these really local endemics in various areas. And you can have, like you see in other insect groups, where you've got mountaintop species, they can't, you know, jump between mountaintops because of climate between them in the valleys, and so they'll speciate. We also get these little micro-endemics that only specialize in certain habitats. And even though, you know, they can jump, they don't seem to disperse very well. And so Melanoplus, the genus, is speciated quite a bit, and it's really diverse, and they're often quite difficult to tell apart. So it's a neat group to work on because they're diverse. And Melanoplines, in general, the subfamily and Melanoplus, the genus, within grasshoppers, at least in North America, are fairly easy to identify. Melanoplines all have a dark stripe that starts on the head and kind of passes along the eye and then back along the prothorax. And they also have a spur on the throat. They're called spur-throated grasshoppers. It's this little nub between the neck, between the head and the front legs. And so any of the listeners, like, you can go out and identify Melanoplines pretty easily once you know what you're looking for.
Go out there and be a taxonomist. Touch a grasshopper. Don't be like us. Don't be like Jody and I, at least.
No.
Mike seems to not have orthopteran hate.
Throw me in a room with 1,000 grasshoppers. I'll just sit here.
Dissecting genitalia, there are many other insects that is one of the only ways to tell, right?
Yes. But the way Lockwood writes it is that we didn't figure this out for grasshoppers until like the 20s or 30s or 40s. I forget exactly what he says and who did it. I'm sorry, scientists that figured it out. It's established in grasshoppers, but it is true for many other groups. A lot of beetles and other insects are best identified by dissecting out the male genitalia. And I should say, we're not being sexist here. If you think about a lock and key, if the male genitalia is the key that goes into the lock, not to get too graphic, but you can imagine like key in your finger or in your hand, and you can look at the bumps and ridges on it. And if you look at a lock, all of those mechanisms are inside the lock, and most locks look similar from the outside. It's much easier to describe the key than it is the lock. And so that's why we look at male genitalia most of the time and not female genitalia. Unless you've got something like a micro CT scanner, it's very difficult to see what those internal 3D structures look like in female genitalia. So that's why we look at the boys.
Good explainer. So we've established that Rocky Mountain locust is its own distinct species. We have established that it is extinct, not extirpated, but extinct, seemingly gone from the environment. It is not these other candidate organisms, sanguipes, and what's the other one?
There's a couple. So Melanoplus femur rubrum. So if you break that down, femur is like the femur, and rubrum is red, so the red-legged grasshopper.
Right.
And then those were the two historically that were thought to be closely related. Modern DNA evidence suggests that a third species, Melanoplus bruneus, the Mexican locust or something, I forget the common name, is probably the most closely related species to Rocky Mountain locust.
And it's not it, though. Yeah, it is extinct. Correct. We want to know what happened to it, or at least Jeffrey Lockwood seems to want to know what happened to it very acutely. He chases some funding to look at a potential site of frozen grasshoppers. That'll be a story that we'll kind of delve into as we go through his cold case. But before he gets to that point, he sort of talks about all of these different theories that have popped up. So I brought that up because he inherits a job at the University of Wyoming that seems very grasshoppery. It's focused on grasshoppers. And so he inherits this large body of literature. He is reading through it so that he can be the new grasshopper expert. And he has to figure out what is like the current stage of thought about what happened to the Rocky Mountain locust. There have been several culprits brought into the lineup that are a part of this murder investigation that he frames. Culprit number one that is framed up is the growth of alfalfa. So this was an idea that alfalfa, its proliferation on the prairie, its use in agriculture in these states that we've talked about being affected by the locust, that this ultimately did the Rocky Mountain locust in. How compelled were you guys by alfalfa as a culprit?
No. This theory is based on an experiment where, again, I should have written down, I am sorry, scientist that did the experiment.
Gurney?
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
He fed grasshopper nymphs on just alfalfa and then just some other plants. And the ones that were on alfalfa were sickly, died more frequently, didn't turn into adults. Basically, if you feed them just alfalfa, they have a high mortality rate. And so the thought was, if you've got these wide swaths of alfalfa and the grasshoppers are feeding on them, that's a toxic plant to them, or they can't grow on it. And so they died off. But then Lockwood points out there's a follow-up experiment later that as long as you supplement them with like dandelions or some other field weeds, like as long as they're getting something else that's not alfalfa, even if that something else is not even a majority of their diet, the nymphs do just fine. If it's 90% alfalfa and 10% dandelions, they do great. And like every field out there has weeds and, you know, weedy edges. And even once you get outside of alfalfa fields, there's plants that aren't alfalfa.
The other kind of nail in the coffin for that one was that the adults do quite well on alfalfa. So the nymphs, they don't flourish when fed alfalfa, but it is a viable food resource for adults to use. So locusts would be very happy to eat it, mow it down, and then go lay eggs elsewhere where the nymphs are going to get that diversified diet that Mike is alluding to. So alfalfa also, some of the reasons that it looked at was that the increase of alfalfa acreage kind of coincided with the disappearance of Rocky Mountain locust. But like we said, it doesn't seem like the scientific data backs up that this is really truly the sole cause of the extinction of this pest. That leads to culprit number two, bison extirpation. I love bison. I think they're a really cool animal. Glad we're trying to bring them back. But they were sort of lords of the plains, I guess, for a long time. They were one of the keystone species out there. And, you know, to put it, maybe oversimplify it, the pioneers came through and they killed them all for various reasons. Some of it was capitalism. Some of it was to harm the native peoples. It was not a cool thing to do. Is that oversimplifying things, Mike?
Oh, no, that's definitely oversimplifying it. A lot of it was to, if you kill the bison, then the native people are going to die too, because that's, you know, their main food source and their main source of clothing, and everything on the plains is based on bison. Like, I'm sure our listeners have seen like the photo of the pile of skulls from the early 1900s. We almost did drive them extinct, this animal that had millions of individuals out there. And Lockwood points out with the alfalfa theory, with the bison theory, and the next one we're going to talk about as well, everybody kind of had this idea like Rocky Mountain locust was this giant thing, so it had to have a giant cause to go extinct. Like, we're looking at these big factors, these big changes, and bison being wiped out is a big change. You know, all of a sudden there's these billions of animals that are gone and not doing what they did on the plains. So maybe that had something to do with it. And the disappearances did kind of coincide, like Rocky Mountain locust is gone, just as the settlers are getting in and killing all the bison, and then the bison are gone and Rocky Mountain locust doesn't come back.
Yes,
but he points out some reasons that this is probably also not true. So what are some of those reasons?
Well, before I jump into that, I also wanted to sort of compliment Lockwood on where he sort of juxtaposes the bison and the locust and talks about how these are like the two biggest eaters in the plains ecosystem. And he doesn't like contrast them and make them yin and yang or anything like that, but it is more of a like, look at the immense scale of what this meant, like having all of these mouths to feed no matter which species, and sort of making it out to be just how impressive the locusts were, I guess. Like with that many bison, you think of the tonnage of animal with one bison versus one locust. And then you compare these huge crowds of both species and you realize just how many locusts there were, right? Like the idea that they weighed the same overall as the bison probably did.
Yeah. And so he does some like back of the envelope math, which, you know, factor of 10, maybe one way or the other, but broadly is probably right that there was somewhere between 30 and 60 million bison at their peak, which meant there was around 11 million tons of just bison out there. Compare that to the big Rocky Mountain locust outbreak, where there was calculated to be 15 trillion Rocky Mountain locusts. And that factors to about 8.5 million tons of locusts. So, you know, within a couple of million tons, either way, you've got Rocky Mountain locusts equaling the biomass of bison in the plains. So yeah, exactly like you said, these two giant, if you think of their biomass like a furnace that you're just shoveling plants into because they're burning that plant matter up in the form of energy and reproduction, like they're equally big.
They need calories. Go ahead.
Oh, I have a note here, like, and it's like the passenger pigeon in the East. Mm-hmm. You know, passenger pigeons were east of the Mississippi, and these two organisms were west of the Mississippi largely. Bison did occur like all the way out into Pennsylvania in smaller numbers. But you've got these just giant super organisms that are eating stuff. And we managed to wipe out all three of them.
Yep, we sure did.
There's the role of the bison, and then they revisited it back 15 years. So yeah. It was for the bison, and then it was against the bison. So it was interesting that they came up twice.
Yeah, so it is a two-pronged thing. One is that the outbreaks are caused by the loss of bison, that having the bison disappear creates this off-kilter ecosystem in which a pest is going to thrive. We see that even to this day, where you go through and you cut a new road into an area, it gets infested with pests and pest plants even more quickly than the surrounding established ecosystem. So there was some idea that these outbreaks are a result of the pioneers killing all the bison. And then this other thing that Jody's alluding to is, no, actually the loss of the bison is what kills the locust, because not having them there to trample things and to poop all over the place and to like alter the ecosystem by rubbing trees down to nubs and creating these pockets of big grassy areas, without the bison there to do all that, this leads to the locust passing away. Both of these end up getting disproven in various ways. The outbreaks precede the bison being lost. So in terms of when like the death knell for the bison was rung and when the major outbreaks that we've discussed occurred, we also can look throughout history and see that there were constant outbreaks of locusts, it sounds like, based on some of this glacial spelunking that he does later. It seems like, you know, they are cyclical. And so saying, oh, having the bison go away that creates the outbreak conditions doesn't seem to add up. And then there doesn't seem to be a lot of water carried for the loss of bison leading to the locust demise. Do you want to talk about that, Mike?
It's fairly similar to the bison being the cause, though, isn't it? Like, there's just cyclical outbreaks before the bison disappear. So whatever bison aren't attached to the disappearance at all, is there another reason I'm forgetting?
From what I remember, it was that, and basically, like, it didn't seem like they liked the areas in which the buffalo trampled anyway. Like, they would eat the grass, but they didn't like to lay their eggs where the buffalo had roamed.
Oh, yeah, because it turns out, thankfully, because C.V. Riley et al. recorded all of this, Rocky Mountain locusts really like to lay their eggs in undisturbed habitats. And so if you've got a big area of plains that is being trampled by bison, the locusts won't lay their eggs there because it's too disturbed. Oh, he also points out like bison were extirpated, but then you've got cattle that are brought in that aren't a 100% proxy because they do, you know, we know now bison disturb the ground in ways that are different from cattle. So they're not a one-to-one, but you've still got these large ungulates that are disturbing the soil, eating the grasses, doing similar enough disturbance that you would think that switching one for the other would not be the reason that Rocky Mountain locusts go extinct.
The poo's a little different too, right?
Yeah. I think it's wetter. Cow poo's wetter.
Cow poo is way wetter. So we've crossed off alfalfa. We've crossed off the loss of bison. That brings us to climate. Jody was alluding to climatic variability earlier in her studies on locusts. This is complicated in the era that we're discussing because of the Little Ice Age. It is coming to an end right around this time. There is an increase in weather variability. There are warming temperatures, which would seem to favor the locust. I think that that's kind of the death knell for this theory is, well, why would they be doing so poorly if it's getting warmer? As Jody talked about, right? You said that when it gets hotter and drier, that's going to be good for the locust preceding a wet weather event.
I did say that.
Yeah, but broadly, with this theory, with the climate, if things are getting warmer, it should be improving for the locusts, not causing them to go extinct. I guess you can make the argument that any kind of variability is going to open the door for tragedy where things could go wrong in some way. But I was never very compelled by the climate theory. Did you find it?
They had it mostly by specific local weather.
Right.
I mean, it wasn't like what we're talking about now, I think. Like they were talking about in the 1870s, like this outbreak was quashed by the Midwestern locales by being unusually wet. There were things that showed up in the data that didn't agree with that theory that it was the climate change.
Yeah, it didn't seem to last very long as a possible theory. That led to one that I've heard about before and I found kind of compelling, this idea of fire being an impact on them. So if it is getting hotter and drier, potentially, there's going to be more fires. There's also some anthropology that's getting used here, talking about the use of fire by native peoples to create more grasslands. This is a book written in 2004. So I think as a 2022 reader, it's a bit striking to remember how recently we were talking about native peoples in these ways, like that this was a surprise. Mike, I don't know if you want to comment on that at all, but like the sort of shock, like, oh, we have to admit, like maybe they were cleverer than we give them credit for, is a sentence I hadn't expected to read, I guess.
There was a couple places like that, and there's one, I don't know if we'll touch upon it later, but yeah, there was just a couple ways that he talks about native peoples that is, like you said, jarring, because yeah, the realization, like, oh, they altered the landscape around them. It wasn't just this kumbaya living in nature. They didn't affect anything. They were ecosystem engineers in the same way that European settlers are too, and humans everywhere are. Yes, obviously.
Right. Yeah, I guess that the idea that that was intriguing or revolutionary in 2004, I had thought that we had crossed that bridge earlier than that, I guess. But that's not really what we're here to talk about today necessarily. The idea of fire having an impact on either the locust outbreaks or the locusts going extinct. In terms of the outbreaks, that fire wasn't happening as frequently. That to me would seem to indicate the extinction way, which is, I think, where the idea kind of pivots to, is that, oh, well, without these fires, trees are going to move in. The landscape is going to go from grassy to more arboreal, which does not favor the locust necessarily as much. And this is going to go on down the line and lead to their extinction. The other parts, I guess, that I found interesting are these ideas that maybe the fire had always been sort of associated with bison, but Lockwood points out like maybe it was to farm locusts. He talked about the pickled bodies of them being plucked from the Great Salt Lake and that there's human feces there that is comprised primarily of locust DNA, I guess, is what it would have to be, right, to get that kind of analysis.
Oh, you could, the locust bits, the chitin doesn't digest.
Right.
So
okay.
Yeah, if you pull it apart, you can find the bits in there.
So they were sorting through the poo and finding the locust bits.
It's old enough that it's...
It's no, yeah, you're right. It's sanitary. I wasn't criticizing. That was an intriguing take to me, is that, oh, you know, this is a really protein-filled snack. Like, maybe this was not only something they were doing on purpose, but something that was sort of celebrated. Like, they liked the locust. And then not having people eat them anymore, maybe that contributed to the outbreaks. That was kind of where I was going with that. But with the fire, it just doesn't seem to add up. Like, fire still happened. There were wildfires and things that would go through and rage across the plains. And so it didn't seem to last very long as a theory either. Yeah.
Like, we should say this strikes happen.
Yeah. Yeah. this is all stuff that's being discussed on like a grander historical scale, maybe like 50 or 60 years of people trying to figure out exactly what happened here. And it is into this milieu that Lockwood kind of inherits this mantle of the Wyoming grasshopper researcher. I liked his sort of description of, it's something that you, I think, are very interested in, Mike, like the lineage of different faculty positions and even like our lineage as learners, like who came before you as your mentor and then their mentor on down the line. And so I liked how he kind of framed that up and like how he gets interested in figuring out what happened to the locust. Do we want to talk about his adventures a little bit before we introduce ultimately the guilty suspect, the one that gets convicted, culprit number five, or do we want to just dive right into this perfect storm of problems for the locust?
So we just kind of frame that as like, what were the theories? And at the end of that one chapter, that was beautiful theories and ugly facts. It goes into, those are not just the theories. Those are like the culprits of this murder. And so now all of a sudden it's like the victim are the locusts and they all have alibis because they've all been eliminated as suspects of the locust extinction. And so now it's like this journey and the book totally changes into something else.
Yes. We can quote from the end of Beautiful Theories and Ugly Facts. You can't derive the whole truth from an assemblage of half-truths. In my estimation, the case of the Rocky Mountain locust disappearance needed to be reopened, but nearly a century had passed since the last individual was seen, and there were no living witnesses to provide insights, and two generations of entomological detectives had puzzled over the available information. It's easy to dismantle someone else's case. It's not so simple to build a new one. I mean, that could be right out of Sherlock Holmes right there.
Yeah, he definitely takes some liberties at points to add some flourish.
Well, I mean, he's writing a public consumption book. I'm okay with that.
So sorry for interrupting. Carry on.
No, that's perfect.
He does, at least my reading of it, and like you said, there's this stark transition where maybe I forgot that he mentions it at the beginning of the book, but we've had half to three quarters of the book so far where he's talking about Rocky Mountain locusts and the history of it. And then he comes in like, and I am the person that is going to solve it, me. And it was just really, I found it off-putting. It was this really stark transition from what was happening to this very, this is my story now, and I'm going to tell the research that we did and how I in my lab solved it.
It's a little bit like investigator bias. Like if you're the one doing the study, all of a sudden you're in it. So you're affecting everything around it. Whereas before it was like, these are like the information. These are the facts. This is history, this and so on. And then all of a sudden it's like, hey, and this is my adventure. This is how I got the funding. This is what we're doing. The secret's in the ice and we're going to chip it out.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And which his adventure stories are cool. Like I enjoy reading them. I wish I could go do this field work. I just wish it was set up a little bit different and maybe more integrated into earlier parts of the book. So it's less like this 180 of historical stuff. And then what he's doing modern wise, like Lockwood says, Rocky Mountain locusts are no longer here. You can't find them anymore. So how does he determine the best way to like go about and find Rocky Mountain locusts that are still out there?
Well, wasn't his like Eureka event, like wasn't he like driving in a car somewhere and
coffee infused blue Chevy pickup?
He was talking about monarchs and all of a sudden it was just like hits him in the
I think that was a very important moment in the evolution of his story. He's already at that point sort of dipping around in glaciers. So like he's had people come to him, or he's met people in Wyoming, which he describes as like one city with long streets or something, right? Because it's 500,000 people-ish for a whole state. And so he meets these folks that have found grasshopper bodies in glaciers. He learns more that there's people that have reported on this before. And so he's like, there's got to be some Rocky Mountain locusts up there. Is that what you were digging at, Mike?
Yeah, because he sets up his stories of going to three separate glaciers over three separate field seasons. And, you know, the first couple are a big bust. They hike up to these glaciers that are difficult to get to, and they find locusts. But, you know, at one glacier, there's Rocky Mountain locusts there, but the glacier has melted too much and they're just kind of mush.
They're soupy.
Yeah, like you can pull them out and tell like, oh, these were probably Rocky Mountain locusts, but they're after like DNA and they're so decomposed, you can't get anything out of it. Then they go to the next glacier, which is also difficult to get to, and find like all of these locusts that are up here are mostly things that are living down in the valley below. They're modern species that have been swept up. And so that's a bust. And then the third glacier they go to, they get out there and it's a horrendous hike through like terrible conditions. The road that used to go up there in the 50s is all overgrown and they can't make it via a truck like you could 50 years before. They have to hike up these treacherous like dozen miles and they camp out and they get over this moraine, which is like the last, it's the rocks that are deposited by the glacier before it starts retreating, and they can see the glacier off in the distance. But it's like the end of the day and then somebody gets hurt. And so they have to go back to camp and rest for a few days. And then a blizzard comes and they can't get to that glacier because there's snow on it and they can't make it up there. And so that field season is a bust. Finally, in the fourth field season, they get up to Knife Point Glacier and manage to find Rocky Mountain locusts entombed in the ice.
What does that mean? Like, why are they trying to find them in the ice?
They want the genitalia preserved. Like, he needs male grasshoppers with intact ediaguses that they can compare against the museum specimens, which I have to assume was a big ask as well, to be like, oh yeah, I need one of the 400 existing museum specimens and I need to cut it open and see if it's a male or female. And that way we can look, or maybe there are illustrations from the past. I'm not sure. I assume that they needed a Rosetta Stone ediagus to be able to do this though.
Yeah. Well, and there's some other things that you can get from it. He does talk about that they discovered that you can identify grasshopper species by the shape of the mandibles.
Yep.
Which is cool. So you can start to identify some of these disarticulated ones just based on the mandibles that you pull out of the ice, which is that's cool. But they want to look at like historical outbreaks. If you've got these giant swarms of Rocky Mountain locusts and they're being swept up into these glaciers and preserved, you're going to end up getting them like layers in a book where you've got a layer of grasshoppers and then a bunch of ice and a layer of grasshoppers and a bunch of ice over successive years. And that is one way to look at historically Rocky Mountain locust outbreaks through time, because they're sitting there preserved in the ice. And in Knife Point Glacier, that's actually exactly what they find. If you think about a glacier, it's like tree rings where you've got a layer of ice and then the next summer some pollen and dirt get blown up from the valley below. And so you've got a dark layer and then another layer of ice and so on and so forth every year. And they find that there's these layers of locusts and they can count back like the layers of a tree ring and see that every 7 to 10 years, there is a locust layer. And you can see like there's this periodicity to Rocky Mountain locust outbreaks. And so all of these theories that we've talked about, the bison and the climate change and all of that, like they're all thrown out because Rocky Mountain locust outbreaks have just happened for as long as we've got this record in these glaciers, 200 years back. And they do things like some carbon 14 dating on them to establish like, yes, we're counting the rings right in these glaciers. These dates are correct. We've got locusts from the 1500s or whatever.
Right.
Yeah. So that's part of the reason that they're looking up there. They also do a really neat thing where, you know, the glaciers then, even in the 90s when he's doing this work, are melting and we know that they're retreating. I mean, it's worse today, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he sets up a scene across some of this glacial meltwater and catches debris that's coming down out of the melting glaciers. And they just get scads of grasshopper mandibles because that's the hardest part of the grasshopper that can survive being melted out of the ice. And so he calculates, and I'm not sure if I wrote it down, just how many grasshoppers are in these glaciers that we're losing per year because the glaciers are melting. And it's on the order of, you know, millions of bodies right. in the ice.
Tons of data cascading down the mountain, unfortunately. I think that I wanted to sort of nail down and say, he talks extensively about trying to get these expeditions funded, that they don't get enough to like really convince people on the first two. And so it gets dicey, the funding situation, each time that they fail to like find the mother load of grasshoppers that he describes. And beyond that, he's trying to publish on this as he goes. And he starts getting comments like, well, you've already found, quote unquote, found this grasshopper three or four times. Like, how many more times do you plan on publishing on this? It seems like it's not being viewed very positively. I think it's important. They have firmly found now that the Rocky Mountain locust is not any of these other species. They have fully confirmed that, which seems important. Is that important, Mike?
Yeah, because they also find some of these other species in the glaciers.
Right.
In kind of a passing comment that he makes, like they find lots of Rocky Mountain locusts, but they also start finding some long-winged specimens of species that we didn't know previous to these glacier finds that would produce long-winged migratory individuals. And even some of these species that are percipterous that have short wings that even as solitary adults aren't functional, they can't fly. Some of these things will produce occasionally long-winged individuals that get sucked up onto these glaciers, which I think is a really cool natural history find.
Yeah, that is a cool find. But it still doesn't answer his central question, which is, what happened? Where did this thing go? Why did it disappear? And this gets back to what Jody brought up earlier, which is this eureka moment talking about monarch butterflies as a migratory insect. It sounds like he's in a truck with his buddy. They're drinking coffee. And they're talking about the decline in monarchs, and they start sort of building this idea that maybe we're looking at this all wrong. And they're not necessarily the first people to ever consider this, obviously, but that they need to go to where these grasshoppers were grasshoppers and solitary, and they need to figure out what happened there in order to figure out what happened to the larger scale migratory population. Mike talked about how everybody's thinking on this macro grand scale earlier, that it has to be this continental change when really maybe it was fairly localized. And he builds a compelling case. Like if he's the prosecutor, I don't know who the defense is necessarily, but if I'm in the jury, I do feel the evidence that he presents is quite compelling. This idea that if we look at all of these different factors that we can outline here in a second, it does seem like this is probably the most likely scenario. So let's talk about what happened. Do either of you want to outline sort of what occurs, perhaps in the historical record?
We mentioned the monarchs. Jody, do you want to talk about what monarchs do when we get to that point? Why these two things seem relevant to each other? Because we don't really talk about, we've mentioned monarchs, but not why he has this eureka moment.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure we've done episodes on monarchs and they're the most recognized butterfly. We all love them. They have this incredible life cycle and journey to overwinter in Mexico or in the South. We've got a population in the West. We've got a population that goes to Mexico. And we have been finding huge declines over, you know, the years. And some years are better than others. A lot of things have to do with climate change. But there is also a big reason, because when they overwinter, that area in Mexico is known for like logging, and all of these butterflies are there. As Lockwood says in this book, like the population is only as safe as its weakest link. And so he finds that the weakest link is there at their overwintering site, because if they're not there to spend the winter, there's going to be less and less butterflies flying back north to have their generations and generations moving up, laying eggs, and then them all coming back. So he's talking about an ecological bottleneck. And we see that with the monarchs, our North American population. And so that's what gives him that eureka moment, that these are migratory grasshoppers coming in from other places. So he's looking for their permanent zone where they're most vulnerable because of their life cycle.
Yeah. So he makes the connection between monarchs and Rocky Mountain locusts, like, where is the weakest link in this life cycle? It's not when they're explosive locusts across the plains. It's when they're reproducing as solitary individuals in the permanent zone somewhere in the valleys of the Rocky Mountains. He builds the case that if this is the weakest link in their life cycle, what's happening in the Rocky Mountains at this time? Well, you've got the European settlers that have come across the plains. We've now hit the Rocky Mountains. It's not great, most of this area, for farming. A lot of what's going on is mining and timbering and associated things, but you still have to have some food production. And the only places in the mountainous areas that you can produce food are these mountain river valleys. You've got a creek or a stream or a river coming down, and you've got some soil that is good for farming along the banks of that. And so what happens, you have farmers coming into these river valleys, they're tilling up the soil, they are eroding the banks because of all the cattle that are brought in. You have all of this environmental change and disturbance happening in these river valleys. And when you go back and read through some of what C.V. Riley said, this is the habitat that Rocky Mountain locusts preferred in the permanent zone. When they're solitary individuals, they really like this area near streams that isn't wet and inundated on the stream bank, but isn't too far away from the streams that it gets dried. They like this like Goldilocks zone near the creeks, but not too close and not too far away. And what happens, that's exactly where European farmers are going to come in, till the soil, disturb the soil, disturb their eggs, which we established earlier in the book is a great way to kill Rocky Mountain locusts, because you don't kill them when they're the big adults that are flying around, or even the nymphs that are crawling along. The best way to kill them is to kill the eggs, turn the soil over, either bury them or expose them to predators. And so if you look through the historical record, right when Europeans start moving into these Rocky Mountain river valleys is right about the time when Rocky Mountain locusts seem to go extinct. They have this last major outbreak, then they retreat back to the permanent zone. All of this change and disturbance happens. He also links in cattle farming in these areas. Cattle are still a big problem for water. They get in, they eat all of the vegetation along the sides of the banks. That causes erosion, which causes much more extreme flooding in these areas. So even if you have areas where Europeans aren't coming in and tilling the soil, you have these major flood events that never happened in the past and inundate the soil around the creeks, which C.V. Riley found is another good way to kill Rocky Mountain locusts. And so he builds this case that this European disturbance in these river valleys in the permanent zone where Rocky Mountain locusts are retreat to outside of their outbreak years, he thinks that this is probably what did them in. We killed them when they were at their weakest in the permanent zone as solitary grasshoppers.
We unwittingly murder them in the crib. I thought of Jody very extensively at this part and her breaking the life cycle. Like, this is IPM, right, Jody?
This is IPM before IPM was a thing.
Absolutely. Unwittingly going in and using some cultural methods, growing alfalfa, I would say, is a cultural method, and then some physical and mechanical control methods of flooding the area on accident and on purpose in some cases, and then plowing, which exposes the buried eggs to the elements, and then having the cattle as another complicating factor where they step on the eggs, it sounds like, in some cases.
I think besides increasing flooding, like, they just disturb the soil in a way that the locust can't handle.
Yeah. And so we rob them of this Goldilocks zone, as Mike termed it, and they can't persist at this basal solitary level to create the outbreaks. And then eventually they peter out. Or do they? The last part of the book seems to be him in thinking that he's found them in Yellowstone.
The last couple pages, he points out that Yellowstone National Park was incorporated before Rocky Mountain locusts go extinct. It is in like the best part of the permanent zone for these grasshoppers. It was never tilled or flooded or anything because it was protected. And he heavily insinuates that this would be the place for Rocky Mountain locusts to persist in the solitary phase if they are still extant and not extinct. And even goes so far to say, like, I've caught some grasshoppers that look suspiciously like Rocky Mountain locusts, but if I pinned them and brought them back and identified them, I'd have to tell everybody. And so I let them go. Now they're out there, and maybe this species, like, it heavily implied, like, this species is still like around in Yellowstone, but I know they're there and now you know they're there, but the government doesn't know they're there. And so they're not going to go in and kill them.
The identities and location have not been reported to authorities.
Yeah. Which it's a cool idea, obviously, like as a force of nature, as this super organism that is a locust swarm, like they're not doing that across the landscape anymore. I do find the idea that the solitary form is still out there somewhere intriguing, because like it would be great if they weren't extinct. I think that would be really neat, even if they're not, you know, what they were. I'm not sure I buy it, because like they wouldn't have outbroken in the last 100 years. If there's even in one valley, they're still there. I'm not sure I believe it, but I like the idea. It's romantic, certainly.
It is very romantic. It made me feel very Jurassic Parky, I think. Like, oh, they're out there. You know, we can't control it, but like, we can't get rid of them either. In this idea of they're hiding in Yellowstone, which turns it into like Grasshopper Park, I guess, or Locust Park.
It does make me want to like get a permit and go out to Yellowstone and maybe some other areas of the permanent zone and like just collect the heck out of some grasshoppers and see if I can find them. Cause like, wouldn't that be a coup to be the person that rediscovers Rocky Mountain locusts out there? But you know, the other thing is there's locust experts out, or grasshopper experts out west. Other species are still an issue for rangelands and for farming. And I can't believe that one of them wouldn't have found Rocky Mountain locust at some point if they were still extant.
That seems to put a stamp on this book. We have shared some of our thoughts over the entire reading. It seems like we would all encourage people to give it a shot.
I'd give it like a 3.5 out of 5. Like I really like the story. I think he spins a good story. I think he's proposed the most likely scenario as to why they went extinct. I do have issues with some of the pacing and like actual writing of the book, but I think there are elements of it that I certainly enjoyed. And like, I read it once before 15 years ago. I certainly enjoyed going back and reading it again. I'd encourage people to pick it up. There's a lot of good to be found in it.
Yeah, I agree. I learned a lot, especially how just that experience shaped so much. We hear about it in religion. We hear about it in politics. There's like a thing called the locust effect. Have you heard of that?
No, tell me more about that.
So I was looking up the book last night and I saw Locust Effect, and it's some other book. Sort of like how it was in this book. It was like the farmers and the people that really couldn't help themselves, how they were already suffering when something bad happens to them. It's so much harder for them. And it's like the Locust Effect in terms of like, I don't know if it's in terms of criminality or whatnot, but there's certain populations that are less advantaged. And so when something bad happens, they have a hard time getting out of it. So the people that suffer will suffer greatly throughout their lives. So it's like, they call it the locust effect. Hmm. So, I mean, there's so many things incorporated into our lives now that have to do with this historical event that have to do with the locusts. So it was nice to know that background and that history. When it comes to the locusts, when it came to ag and all the stuff we've been reading about, they can relate that experience and those themes elsewhere.
I like that. It does seem kind of poignant to use the locust as the name for that particular effect. Because yeah, like we kind of covered here, these were already people that were in kind of dire straits. Some of them maybe had never farmed before. Some of them had lost jobs in the city. Some of them were desperate for a new start on stolen land, and they were out west trying to farm, which is already tough, and then you have the locusts come through and steal it all out from under you anyway. That's just going to perpetuate things. So we have had a lot of fun, I think, dissecting locusts and Locust the book, and talking about biology and history, and talking about why this is kind of an important story to even talk about to this day. We hope you've enjoyed it too. We hope you've read along as part of the book club. Maybe we'll do this again in the future. I don't know. Maybe we'll pick a shorter book for Jody.
Thanks, guys.
I hope you're not insulted.
No.
We appreciate your time and that you're listening to the show. If you want to find us more on the internet, we are at arthro-pod.blogspot.com. We are also on Twitter, arthro_podshow. You can find us on all of your favorite podcatcher apps. That's Stitcher. It's Apple Podcasts. It's Spotify. On all of these different platforms, you have to do arthro-pod. pod in order to find us. The dash is very important. You won't discover us otherwise. If you do listen to us on those platforms, it would be great if you left us a rating or review. Those help more people find the show, and it helps make it known to us that we are not just shouting into the void. So if you wanted to help us out that way, that would be greatly appreciated. You can find all of us on Twitter for as long as it exists. I'm Bugman John.
I'm at Jody Bugsme, UNL.
And I'm at mscavarla 36.
Ooh, can I give a shout out to pest management professional that came up to me in Portland and said he listened to the show and he said he really liked the Starship Troopers and we should watch more movies. So thank you for listening.
We'll have to do another movie episode. If they have any recommendations, we'd be glad to hear them.
If we're doing thanks to listeners, I had 3 emails after the Deer Cat episode. Which is the most I've ever had anybody outreach after an episode, and might actually form a collaboration with one of them.
Nice.
So thank you all for reaching out. I really appreciate it. And like Jody said, we love hearing from listeners because half the time we feel like we're shouting into the void. So when you guys give us a pat on the back, it feels real good. So thank you all. And thank you all for listening.
It is a time of Thanksgiving, so we appreciate you. We hope you'll tune in next time when we bring you more bug-filled awesomeness, and we'll see you then and there.
It's time for our insect heroes to put away their nets and pheromone traps. Join us next time, same bug time, same bug channel, as the Arthropod Gang make the world safe from poor insect podcasts. Until then,
keep on bugging.
Okay.
I'm going to try to keep it on track today.
Where did Mike go? We'll edit this out.